Hey everyone, this is Tiana, your host of the True Crime Podcast, Truth Seeker. Just as a note, as this is regarding true crime, episodes may contain graphic and disturbing content, and although not always explicit, listener discretion is advised. I think every parent's worst nightmare is something awful happening to their child. But I think most parents cannot fathom their child going missing into the middle of the night and them not being found for almost 8 years. This is what allegedly occurred in the first case that I'll be talking about. This case covers what is speculated and what little really is known to have happened on the night of October 3rd or early morning of October 4th, 2011. According to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, or NCMEC, and the FBI, in 2018, there were 424,066 FBI National Crime Information Center entries for missing children. NCMEC was founded in 1984 by the Walshes along with other child advocates. Over the last 33 years, NCMEC has received over 4.8 million calls. Now, these numbers do not mean that all of those resulted in true missing children. Most children reported missing are found safe with a simple misunderstanding of where they went, or they may have run off away on their own. NCMEC website breaks down all the variations of those 4.8 million calls. I won't go into all those details in this episode, but I will post a link on my Facebook and website. It should also be noted that many children are never reported as missing, so the numbers may not reflect a true picture. However, 4.8 million calls is something that causes one's heart to drop, regardless if you're a parent or not. The case of the missing child that I will be discussing in this episode captured national attention almost immediately. As I was binge-watching the ID channel and thinking about what case I would cover for my first episode, a show about Lisa Irwin just happened to come on. With that, I thought it would be good to talk about this case in hopes that bringing it back up may generate new leads with more information coming forward. In a news report from October 2018, 7 years after Lisa went missing, police reported to have received 19 tips that year alone. Overall, police have received over 500 tips or leads over the time she has been missing. Yet, she still has not been found, and police seem no closer to finding or knowing what happened to her. This episode is dedicated to missing Lisa Irwin, or as most media coverage still has it, Baby Lisa. There is a website dedicated to Lisa Irwin, called Find Lisa Irwin, which I will post a link in the show notes. It still has a $100,000 reward and a flyer with an age-progressed photo of what Baby Lisa would look like on the front page. The flyer states kidnapped, which is up for debate as I research this case. So let's get into the case now. Lisa Renee Irwin was born on November 11, 2010 to parents Deborah or Debbie Bradley and Jeremy Irwin in Kansas City, Missouri. Lisa was a blue-eyed, blonde-haired baby girl with a birthmark on her right thigh. She weighed 30 pounds and was 2 feet 6 inches when she disappeared. Baby Lisa was 10 months and 23 days old when she went missing virtually into the night, the 3rd of October or early morning of the 4th of October, 2011, from her home in Kansas City, Missouri, a home that was shared with her parents and two half-sibling brothers, ages 8 and 5. Lisa was last seen wearing a purple shirt with kittens on it and purple shorts. Lisa, if still alive, would be almost 7.5 years old today. To date, Lisa has not been found and the case is still unsolved. I want to add that with many cases you have probably listened, watched, or read on, stories and recollections tend to vary, and while sometimes it can be innocent enough, it does cause one to stop and ponder what really may have happened. I will forewarn you, this happens a lot in this case. And when you add failed polygraphs, and yes, I know they aren't always the most reliable, but just as an added variation, along with uncooperative family, at some point those variations, even to those who try to remain neutral, start to weigh heavy. So please keep those in mind. As I investigated this case, I would have a script laid out, and as I went over it in preparation, I would find yet another version of what reportedly happened. Yet it seems the only thing certain is that no one really knows for sure. This is one of the things that makes this case so frustrating and why, after all these years, I am sure is still unsolved. So why I am sure you will listen to this and say that is not what I heard, read, or saw, I challenge you to try to stay open-minded. It seems that with each news report, TV show, and article you will read, there is some version out there. I have compiled as much information as I could to keep it as clear as I could, but the heart of the story remains centered on Lisa. Regardless if you believe her parents' accounts of everything that happened that evening, this story is heart-wrenching. And please, if you know something that could help the police out, let them know. I am sure that more than anyone, they want the truth out about what happened to Lisa. Now, back to the case. Lisa's father, Jeremy, was working a night shift on the 3rd of October, which, according to both Jeremy and Debbie, was not typical. Debbie stated that she had a friend over to keep her company, as she was anxious to be home alone with the three young children. I want to add, just for informational purposes, that the two half-siblings of Lisa were from Jeremy, and according to a website, they don't have the same mother. Now, that may not necessarily be pertinent to the case, I just wanted to add as much information as I was able to come across. I don't feel that adding her brother's names would help this case out, as they were very young when this happened, and were talked to by police and experts in the hours right after Lisa went missing. According to a news report, police requested another interview after investigators had gathered more information. They also wanted to collect DNA from the boys to compare to DNA found in the home. However, the parents, Jeremy and Debbie, ended up canceling an interview that was scheduled to happen, appearing to hinder the investigation. But the brothers were eventually interviewed a second time on what just so happened to be the day before Lisa's first birthday. As with most of the cases, which are still considered open, nothing further was reported about what was discussed with the boys or the parents during these interviews. As I researched the case, I came across some other armchair detectives lay out some speculation that their biological mothers had lost custody of the boys, and some speculated that that could have been a motive of sorts. But so far, in what I could find, nothing from police regarding that has been reported, so for right now, there is nothing to warrant going down that rabbit hole, yet. As I continue to investigate, there could possibly be a follow-up or subsequent episode covering various speculations. Okay, back to the accounts of that evening. Debbie's friend was reported to be there for a few hours. According to Debbie, she put Lisa in her crib around 6:30 or 6:40 that evening of the 3rd, although information on the FBI's website states Lisa was last seen at 6 p.m. on October 3rd. One account of that night, Debbie stated that they checked on the children at various times throughout the night, and when her friend went home before Debbie went to bed, she had checked on Lisa one last time about 10:40 p.m. Although in subsequent interviews, Debbie admitted she could not remember if, in fact, she did check on Lisa before she had gone to bed. But then she thought she had checked on her while her friend was still at the house. Debbie had also admitted that she and her friend had been outside that evening smoking and drinking. This information about drinking will be important later in the episode when theories start to arise about what happened to Lisa. Initially, Debbie and Jeremy both stated that he thought he would be home by 11 p.m., but the job ended up taking much longer than he thought, and according to Jeremy, he was home more like 3 or 4 a.m. in the morning of the 4th. Again, with another variation in stories, as some reports state, he was home more along the lines of 2:30 a.m. When Jeremy got home, he stated that he noticed right away that the front door was unlocked, which was not typical. When he entered the house, he also noted that more lights were on throughout the house than usual. He stated that he began then to walk through the entire house. According to Jeremy, in a People Investigates episode, he went to his bedroom first and saw that his wife and one of his sons were asleep in the bed together. He then went into his other son's room and found him tucked in his bed and asleep. He then finally went into Lisa's room, and that is when he noticed that she was not there in her crib. He immediately went back to his and Debbie's bedroom to alert her that Lisa was not in her crib. Debbie claims that she jumped out of bed right away and began to run around the house. She stated that she yelled for the boys to wake up and have them start searching everywhere and look for baby Lisa, to look under her bed anywhere she could be. Debbie then began calling out for Lisa around the house, even though according to Debbie, she did not believe Lisa could have gotten out of the crib by herself. At one point, Debbie stated that Jeremy took a flashlight to search the outside and back of the house while Debbie stayed inside with the boys. Jeremy then claimed he ran to the neighbor's house, the one who had been over with Debbie that night, to tell her that Lisa was missing. He also wanted to check to see if by any chance she had the baby and Debbie had forgotten. However, after conducting a search of the neighbor's house, baby Lisa was nowhere to be found. When he re-entered his home again, he stated he noticed that a screen on a window was missing and that the window was ajar. He also stated that three cell phones were missing. At that point, he and Debbie assumed that someone had come into the house and had taken baby Lisa. Later, authorities would reattempt a reenactment on that window that Jeremy had pointed out and reach a conclusion that it was an unlikely point of entry. When police asked Jeremy how he called 911 if the phones were missing, Jeremy stated that he used his work cell phone to make the call. This is another part of the story that changes in interviews and articles I researched, but I'm trying to get the version that seems to be the most consistent out there. As I am sure by now, you are starting to realize that there is a lot of speculation surrounding the parents and their ever-changing recollection of events from that evening. And I will say here that as a parent, I cannot even begin to imagine what that feels like to wake up and your child is missing. If the circumstances were as the parent said, and they truly have no idea, I could imagine that the events of that night play over and over all the time. And maybe with time, they gain some clarity or could forget things. Changes would occur, and that does not necessarily point to guilt, but for some it does. I can admit I myself had many questions, especially when I watched the ID Channel People magazine episode that covered this case. They lawyered up quickly, which caused a lot of speculation, but then they also hired their own private investigator, which started to have some believe their stories of what happened. Okay, I digress. Back to that evening. Police were contacted around 4 a.m., and upon arrival, they began a search of the Bradley and Irwin's home and surrounding areas. Jeremy, from the beginning, insisted to the police that someone took Lisa, and it had to be through the window of the missing screen. However, remember, as I mentioned, the police did a reenactment and found it unlikely. Police searched the entire inside and outside of the home. They searched fields near the home, as well as their neighbors' homes. And at one point, they even drained wells in hopes of finding baby Lisa. All searches came up empty. Nothing. No signs of her whatsoever. An Amber Alert was also issued. After the Amber Alert was issued, police started receiving tips. Police stated that they did receive reports of a man in the neighborhood carrying what appeared to be a baby. However, it appears from my research that there was no positive identification of that man, as the eyewitnesses that came forward did not provide similar accounts on what he looked like. One witness, Mike Thompson, had spoken to ABC News and stated that on his way home from work on the 4th of October at about 4 a.m., he said that he saw a man in a t-shirt carrying a baby at the intersection 3 miles or so from the Irwin home. Thompson pointed out that it was weird because it was 4 a.m. and about 45 degrees out, and the man and baby did not have any coats on. He also stated that it was so unusual, he later considered even offering the man and child a ride home, but really could not because he had been on his motorcycle. Thompson described the man seen as being around 5'7" and somewhere between 140 to 150 pounds, and that he could possibly be in his late 30s or early 40s. The other witness or witnesses was a couple that lived 3 houses down from the Irwins. What they said they saw was something similar. They also reported it to the police, but there was no physical description of the man except that he was wearing a t-shirt. However, in the report, they stated that they believed the baby did not have any clothes on, just a diaper. They said they had seen an arm and a leg, and the baby did not appear to have anything on. Later on in the investigation, surveillance footage of a mystery man surfaced. Reports stated that Good Morning America obtained a video of a man dressed in white seen leaving a wooded area around 2:30 a.m. the night Lisa went missing. In a news report, a former FBI agent and ABC News consultant, Brad Garrett, said the timeline of events is strange, stating, are you going to logically abduct a child, let's say in the midnight area, then 2 to 4 hours you are spotted in the proximity of the neighborhood? He stated it just didn't seem to make any sense. He went on to say it could be true, of course, but the logic of abducting a child is so you can take the child to some other location. The police also started to focus on the missing phones. The missing cell phones ended up pinging in the immediate area of the Irwin home, and during the review of where the phones were pinging, they had what was thought to be a big break in the case. A phone call was placed from one of those phones the night baby Lisa went missing. Police received information from a woman named Megan Wright. Megan stated in a news report that police had questioned her several times regarding a phone call she received from one of the supposedly missing cell phones. It was reported that the call only lasted 50 seconds, and it was to Megan's cell phone. Megan told police and news reporters that she did not know Debbie Bradley or Jeremy Irwin and has no idea where Lisa is. Megan also stated that she did not even answer that particular call in question, and if someone did answer it, she has no idea who it was because she was out with friends that night. Megan stated that all she knows of what is going on with Lisa is what she has been told by police during questioning. Police told her that a call was made during the night that Lisa disappeared, however, the exact time of the call is uncertain. There are various news reports quoting police stating that they believe the call was either made at 8:30 p.m., 11:57 p.m., or 2:30 a.m. I am very confused as to why the uncertainty of the call in these different articles. It should be very easy for police to clear this up with cell phone records, as the call was placed from one phone to the next with a precise time listed. This is a clarification that I believe needs to be made by police to clear up some of the confusions in some of the articles. But this led to one of the three main suspects, or persons of interest, should I say, coming into the picture. Megan Wright had broken up with a man, John Tanko, also known as Jersey, weeks before Lisa disappeared. Jersey was a transient handyman in the neighborhood that Lisa lived. Many of the reports I have read during my review for the case stated John was questioned many times by police and had cooperated with them. It was also stated that the police have moved on with the investigation, apparently away from him and more focused on the parents. This is what we'll talk about next, the focus on the parents of Lisa Irwin. In this part of the episode, I want to go into where most of the suspicions seem to lie on the disappearance and what most people believe to have happened that night that Lisa mysteriously vanished. It is hard to get to the heart of what happened when the people closest to this case shut down and refused to cooperate with police anymore. But after failed polygraphs and the heat being turned up, I could see why the family would want to stay clear of authorities. But if they did not have anything to hide and wanted to find out what really happened to Lisa, why would they avoid police? That is a question most people ask. On Facebook, interviews, Reddit, why avoid police, the ones with the resources to help you find your daughter? And why so soon after the investigation began? Although it appears that at some point the parents did start to work with police again. But I believe the damage was what had already been done when they stopped. The widespread speculation ran rampant by that point. And while conducting research for this case, a report I read from September 2016 by KCTV Kansas City News, it sent chills down my back and made every hair on my body stand on end. This is where it is reported that a cadaver dog alerted to something in the parents' bedroom. The report also went on to say that police found burnt baby clothes inside a neighborhood dumpster. But what got me is the cadaver dog hit inside the home. This was huge for me. Look, I listen to a lot of true crime podcasts and watch a lot of true crime TV. Cadaver dogs are trained to smell decomposition of humans. That is it. Not decomposition of anything else but humans. These are not search and rescue dog types that are trained to find a scent of an individual during searches to see where they could have gone. These dogs are trained to find one type of scent, and that is the scent of decomp. This event is part of a police affidavit. This affidavit was filed with the Kansas City court as part of a search warrant on the family home in October 2011, a search that also led to police leaving the home with several items. According to the affidavit, investigators took a multicolored comforter, purple shorts, a Disney character shirt, a glow-worm toy, a Cars-themed blanket, rolls of tape, and a tape dispenser. It struck me reading this list, as Debbie had told police early on in the investigation that Lisa was seen wearing purple shorts the night she disappeared. I also wanted to add that it was also reported in this affidavit that the parents tried to restrict police accessing their home. The team and cadaver dog searched the home on the 17th of October, 2011. This is when the dog positively hit next to the bed on the side that Lisa's mother, Debbie, slept. This is when I believe most people following this case began to speculate that Lisa, in fact, was not actually missing, but had died the night she was reported missing. Speculation began to focus mostly on Debbie. Most of the stories I read, people believe that Debbie, who admittedly was drinking most of the evening with a friend, was more than just a little intoxicated. That she had gone to sleep after her friend left, and when she went to bed, had two of the children with her, Lisa and one of Jeremy's sons. And that sometime during the night, she rolled over on Lisa and smothered her while she was sleeping. Some believe it was an accident of sorts, that she was so drunk that when she rolled on top of Lisa, Debbie did not realize it until it was too late. Other stories I came across where people were discussing the case say that being drunk does not constitute an accident, as Lisa has never been found, and you don't cover up a true accident. It is also believed that in a panic, when Debbie saw that Lisa was dead, she placed Lisa on the floor exactly where the dog had a positive hit and waited until Jeremy got home. This is when they got rid of the evidence and the body of baby Lisa. Okay, now while I believe that this scenario could have happened, just as Lisa could have been abducted in the middle of the night, what baffles me is why some people believe she waited until Jeremy got home and that he helped her. Debbie did make an odd statement to police when she stated that she did not search behind the home because she was afraid of what she might find. And police did state that when they conducted the search of the garden area, they noted that portions of dirt had appeared to be recently disturbed or overturned. But Debbie and Jeremy both stated that the night Lisa disappeared, that he ran outside the house searching for her.
Yes, that could be part of their story. But I still have a hard time believing that if Debbie killed Lisa accidentally while she was passed out drunk, that she would be able to convince Jeremy to help her cover up the death when he arrived home. The neighbor that was over at the house drinking with Debbie gave statements to police of Jeremy coming over frantic and searching for Lisa. To me, I just can't imagine a father going along with covering up an accidental death, along with having time to make up such a story and putting up the act of the neighbor and police. I mean, yes, there are so many variations in timelines. I guess he could have had enough time to get home and process what Debbie had done and panic and then help her. I think that is more plausible of there being more than enough time for Deborah to realize the awful truth and to do something to cover it up than to lie to Jeremy about it when he got home. Or she played it off and that she was sleeping and let him think that someone had taken her and then let the story evolve. In all the reports, articles, and shows I've read and watched, it appears that of everyone involved, her version of events changes the most, to include her failing her first polygraph. Even though, according to Debbie and her attorney, she passed the polygraph and was only told she failed to coerce a confession by police. Now again, as I stated earlier, a failed polygraph does not necessarily point to guilt. It has been noted in various research of these tests that a lot of times people closest to those harmed or missing interviewed can fail tests because of guilt of not realizing something was amiss or feeling they failed the person somehow. I can imagine during a traumatic event, your mind is going a million miles a minute, and maybe with time you gain clarity and some things change. But in this situation, with the ever-changing recollection of events, failed polygraphs, cadaver dog hits, it has to give many people, including myself, too many doubts on their, especially Debbie's, innocence and all of it. The police also had their house processed for fingerprints and DNA in Lisa's room and any points of entry. However, nothing the police collected and processed during any of those searches has led them to look or question anyone else. There have only been three reported persons of interest: Lisa's parents, Debbie and Jeremy, and Jersey, whom according to police was cleared early in the investigation. Police have consistently reported that a major factor that has affected this investigation negatively is that those closest to the case have provided inconsistent and conflicting accounts of that evening. This has led to police having a very difficult time investigating the case from the beginning. The parents, Jeremy and Debbie, retained lawyers very early on, two to be exact. One of which is a very well-known defense attorney from New York, Joe Tacopina. His name might sound familiar to you, as some of his clients included Joran Vandersloot, who was identified as a person of interest in the disappearance of Natalie Holloway from Aruba. He also represented Michael Jackson in a molestation trial, as well as a New York City police officer who was charged of raping an intoxicated woman but was later acquitted. After researching the case and learning about the family, I was curious as to how they could afford such a high-profile attorney. I could not find out in researching the case who actually retained this lawyer for the Irwins and Bradleys, or who may be paying his what I am sure are hefty fees, or if he was working pro bono, which is interesting to me at least. Reports stated that their other attorney was a local Kansas City lawyer who seemed to be much less in the spotlight. According to Tacopina, he defended both Bradley and Irwin, as he put it, ferociously, accepting their presumption of innocence. He went on to say that he gave Debbie a lot of credit for coming out and admitting she was drunk, and that he did not believe that her being drunk had anything to do with it. He also brought up early on that Debbie was being so distraught about her daughter being missing is what led to Debbie changing her recollection of the events of that evening. He then went on to end any more television and radio interviews done by the parents. He stated that the parents, Debbie and Jeremy, would not be sitting down with police for separate interviews as requested by the Kansas City police. He did go on to say that they had already been interviewed together and separately, and that enough is enough because the police were being very accusatory. The separate interviews being conducted, as he stated, is up for debate, as many reports have conflicting information regarding if, in fact, they happened or not. This, of course, led to more widespread speculation on the parents. It is easy to see why, as I've mentioned various times in this episode. That has been it. Three persons of interest: Lisa's parents and the man known as Jersey. On February 3rd, 2012, Debbie and Jeremy appeared on a Dr. Phil episode complaining about the investigation. They stated that this was not a circus, not a joke, or a game, that this is their baby. Before this interview, the parents remained silent for almost 3 months. This interview was different from all the rest that I had watched. They were clearly frustrated and vented about their frustrations. At one point, Debbie became visibly upset when discussing what she says are public misconceptions about her. The topic of her drinking and being drunk came up, and Dr. Phil asked Deborah directly if she was drunk that night. And at first, it seemed she was going to deny it. However, she eventually stated that to her, more than two drinks in an hour means you're drunk. So yes, she was drunk. She states that she can admit that because she has nothing to hide. Both Debbie and Jeremy remained adamant that someone had come into their home in the middle of the night and abducted Lisa. So that is basically it, sadly, on this case. Even with all the attorneys, private investigators, television and radio interviews, this case is still unsolved and Lisa is still missing. As of March 2019, there are no reported hard leads or suspects. Lisa's parents still say that a stranger broke into their home in the middle of the night and kidnapped her. They even went on to say that they believed that she was sold and that it wasn't a one-person job. But here is a statistic I find troubling. Stranger abduction is incredibly rare. According to a KCTV 5 report, there are only a handful of cases of newborn babies being kidnapped, and those are generally violent attacks where infants are cut of the mother's womb. Former FBI agent Michael Tabman stated in a report that Lisa's age troubled investigators, as kidnappings generally involve middle school age children, highlighting high profile cases as 11-year-old JC Dugard, 12-year-old Polly Klaus, and 14-year-old Elizabeth Smart. He then went to say that he did not believe that in Lisa's case, it was a stranger abduction. According to the Federal Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, there were just 105 stereotypical kidnappings of children in the United States in 2011. Most of those kidnappings involved the use of force or threats, and about 3 in 5 victims were sexually assaulted, abused, or exploited. The ages of those victims most commonly are 12 to 17-year-old girls who were or are white and living in situations other than with two biological or adoptive parents. Half of all stereotypical kidnappings in 2011 were sexually motivated crimes against adolescent girls. The site provides a lot more statistics, which I won't go into, but again, we'll post links to. It should also be noted that with technologies such as cell phones and the internet, it has helped law enforcement to solve crimes involving 2/3 of the victims. But one thing that really stood out was that of the 2011 kidnapped children, 8 resulted in homicide and 92 were recovered. It is my hope that discussing this case and speculations on this case with this podcast will help the case be just talked about again and may bring back into light, which will hopefully bring out new leads and information. Please, if you know something, anything at all, contact the Kansas City Crime Stoppers at 816-474-TIPS, or you can visit their website and submit information that way as well. I will have various links in the show notes. I wanted to take this opportunity to end the show by saying thank you to everyone that took the time out of their days to listen and support my podcast. If you like what you heard, please take a moment and leave a rating at wherever you listen to your podcast and also subscribe. This will help me out a great deal with gaining new listeners and followers. Also, please check out my Facebook and Instagram sites as well as my website. Links will be posted in the show notes. I am researching now for my next episodes, and so if you have any cases you think I should cover, please feel free to reach out to me through my social media accounts. I will talk to you all next time.